law to supposedly justify their rulings. For example, in 2000, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg complained that the court did not have the same readiness to look beyond one's shores as other nations. The Supreme Court has mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights a spare 5 times, and only twice in a majority decision. Nor does the U.S. Supreme Court note the laws or decisions of other nations with any frequency. She has said that a boldly dynamic interpretation departing radically from the original understanding of the Constitution is sometimes necessary. Indeed, Ginsburg is not particularly impressed with the Constitution, despite having taken an oath to uphold it. In February 2012, while appearing on Egypt's Al Hayat TV, shortly after the Muslim Brotherhood, among others, overthrew Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and advising the Egyptian people on the adoption of a new constitution, Ginsburg said in part that "You should certainly be aided by all the constitution writing that has gone on since the end of World War II. I would not look to the U.S. Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. I might look at the Constitution of South Africa." That was a deliberate attempt to have a fundamental instrument of government that embraced basic human rights, had an independent judiciary. It really is, I think, a great piece of work that was done. Much more recent than the U.S. Constitution, Canada has a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It dates from 1982. You would almost certainly look at the European Convention on Human Rights. Yes, why not take advantage of what there is elsewhere in the world? In 1988, then Associate Justice John Paul Stevens referred to international standards in the case Thompson v. Oklahoma, respecting the execution of criminals less than 16 years of age. In 2003, Associate Justice Stephen Breyer, a proponent of consulting international law in constitutional cases, gave a speech before the American Society of International Law in which he proclaimed that the global legal enterprise is now upon us. In 2003, Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy cited extensively from international law when writing the court's decision in the Lawrence v. Texas sodomy case. There are numerous other examples. Former Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was even more explicit. In 2002, she asserted in a speech that although international law and the law of other nations are rarely binding decision on U.S. courts, conclusions reached by other countries and by the international community should at times constitute persuasive authority in American courts. She added, "While ultimately we must bear responsibility for interpreting our own laws, there is much to learn from other distinguished jurists who have given thought to the same difficult issues that we face." In 2003, O'Connor wrote, "As the American model of judicial review of legislation spreads further around the globe, I think that we Supreme Court justices will find ourselves looking more frequently to the decisions of other constitutional courts, especially other common law courts that have struggled with the same basic constitutional questions that we have: equal protection, due process, the rule of law in constitutional democracies." In 2004, she declared in yet another speech that international law is no longer a specialty. It is vital if judges are to faithfully discharge their duties. Of course, foreign statutes, constitutions, and judicial decisions have no legitimate relation at all to the proper role of a Supreme Court justice. The legislative history, text, and intention of lawmakers, or, respecting the Constitution, the framers' intent, cannot be divined by inquiring into or relying on international authorities. As I wrote in Men in Black, the court has so fundamentally altered its duties and so completely rejected the limits placed on it by the Constitution's checks and balances and enumeration of powers that the justices are in an endless search for extra-constitutional justifications and interventions to explain their activism. The court that was given life by the Constitution cannot operate outside it. Its only rightful and lawful authority exists solely within and related to the Constitution. James Madison put it this way, "I entirely concur in the propriety of resorting to the sense in which the Constitution was accepted and ratified by the nation. In that sense alone, it is the legitimate Constitution. And if that is not the guide in expounding it, there may be no security." Reality informs us that human beings are imperfect, including the mere 9 individuals who serve on the Supreme Court. The fact that they hold law degrees from prestigious schools, wear black robes, and are each referred to as Your Honor does not change the fallibility of their nature. Nor does the fact that from time to time the court issues rulings with which much of society agrees or which might be considered just or even exceptional. Even monarchs have been occasionally benevolent and wise. But this does not change the essential character of authoritarianism and the general mindset of those who would rule over citizens as subjects. Indeed, history belies the notion of enlightened governing masterminds, immune from republican traditions and values. Whatever one may think of the Marbury decision, it cannot be denied that today the Supreme Court's power is of the sort Wilson envisioned. For example, the court has issued numerous politically determinative decisions, nearly all of which promote a trajectory of expanded federal power, including the court's own authority, in defiance of the Constitution's structure and limits. On such occasions, the justices contort the facts and the law as they must to reach their desired result. In the 1942 Wickard v. Filburn case, the court ruled that the Interstate Commerce Clause encompasses commerce that is intrastate, and therefore the federal government has the power to regulate endless forms of private economic activity, including the production of goods and services for one's own use or use within a state. In the 1947 Everson v. Board of Education decision, it declared the long-standing balance between government and religion void, and the existence of a wall of separation between church and state, leading to the banning of prayer, nativity scenes, and crosses, among other forms of religious expression, in the public square, in states and localities across the nation. In the 1965 case, Griswold v. Connecticut, the court found that the Constitution's so-called penumbras and emanations prohibited states from banning the sale of contraceptives, a ban that was rarely enforced. In its 1982 decision in Plyler v. Doe, the court conferred a constitutional right on millions of illegal alien children to a free public education. In the 2003 Lawrence v. Texas case, the court ruled that sodomy is a constitutionally protected privacy right. Such laws were already being repealed by most states, and in the 2012 Obamacare decision, the court ruled that a penalty is a tax, contrary to the statute's text, legislative history, the court's precedent, and the Constitution's text, and therefore, the federal government has the power to force individuals to purchase government-designed private health insurance policies. Of course, there are many such examples. Some among us cheer these decisions. Some denounce them. But should 5 individuals be making these political and public policy decisions and imposing them on every corner of the nation and every part of society? Should they have the final say on such matters as they pursue even newer and more novel paths around the Constitution in exercising judicial review? It is important to recognize that the Supreme Court's record is at times grievous. In addition to the Dred Scott decision, in which the court perverted the Constitution to promote slavery, other notable examples include the 1896 Plessy v. Ferguson holding, where the court sanctioned racial segregation in public facilities under the doctrine of separate but equal. The 1944 Korematsu versus United States decision, where the court gave license to the U.S. Army's internment of tens of thousands of Japanese Americans without due process, and Roe versus Wade, the 1973 ruling in which the court legalized abortion throughout the nation with no constitutional basis. Judicial review can be exercised for good and bad. It can be exercised wisely and foolishly. That is the court's record. It is the record of every governing body in the United States. It is truly absurd that so many defend the evolutionary role of the modern court as supreme to all other institutions of government and insist on the finality of its rulings. Barely 100 justices have served on the Supreme Court. As few as 5 justices can dictate economic, cultural, criminal, and security policy for the nation. 1 new justice, replacing a retiring or deceased justice, can sway the court in one direction or another. Hence, the political battles for control of the court when vacancies occur. In Men in Black, I explained, the biggest myth about judges is that they're somehow imbued with greater insight, wisdom, and vision than the rest of us. That for some reason, God Almighty has endowed them with superior judgment about justice and fairness. But the truth is that judges are men and women with human imperfections and frailties. Some have been brilliant, principled, and moral. Others have been mentally impaired, venal, and even racist. Consider a few of the stunning personalities who have served on the court. John Rutledge, a 1795 recess appointment as the nation's 2nd Chief Justice, was considered mentally unstable. Henry Brockholst Livingston, appointed in 1806, killed a man in a duel before his appointment. Henry Baldwin, appointed in 1830, was reportedly insane. Robert C. Greer, appointed in 1846, became mentally incapacitated, yet continued his duties on the court. Nathan Clifford, appointed in 1858, suffered a stroke and became a babbling idiot. Stephen J. Field, appointed in 1863, gradually lost his mind. Joseph McKenna, appointed in 1897, became mentally unstable and resisted retirement. James C. McReynolds, appointed in 1914 by Woodrow Wilson, was a notorious anti-Semite and racist. Hugo Black, appointed in 1937 by Franklin Roosevelt, had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan and remained on the court despite his declining mental health. William O. Douglas, appointed in 1939, allegedly sexually assaulted a flight attendant in his chambers and remained on the court despite suffering an incapacitating stroke. Abe Fortas, appointed in 1965, continued to advise President Lyndon Johnson after his appointment and supplemented his court salary from a foundation set up by a convicted stock swindler and was eventually forced to resign. Thurgood Marshall, appointed in 1967, in his waning years, apparently spent many hours watching television in his chambers, especially soap operas. The mechanisms the framers put into operation, relating to the judiciary, were designed to achieve certain vital purposes that would in turn help ensure the successful operation of the federal government they established. They knew the sordid history of monarchs and bureaucracies compromising jurisprudence to serve political ambitions, and they did not want that result in the United States. They sought the independence of the judiciary to help establish and preserve the integrity of the federal judicial system, and by extension, the federal government itself. They included a procedure to evaluate nominees for the federal judiciary, the presidential nomination/senatorial confirmation process, as well as hold justices and judges accountable for their misdeeds, the impeachment process. But the power the Supreme Court exercises today is not the authority contemplated or granted by the framers, Incidentally, the same can be said of the other branches. It is not sanctioned in the Constitution. It is not consonant with Republican government. Moreover, impeachment is mostly a dead letter, except in outlandish cases of criminal misbehavior. However, it is clear that the notion of judicial review has long been acquiesced to and is now ingrained in such a way as to make its uprooting imprudent, if not impossible. That said, there is no reason a great society must surrender, for all time and in all cases, to a judicial oligarchy exercising supreme power over the other federal branches and the states. The Supreme Court is to be independent in its judicial deliberations, but not supreme in all matters, leaving society without recourse. The proposed amendment seeks to return the court to its proper foundational role within a republican system of government. It does the following. 1. Ends the lifetime term of justices and replaces it with a single 12-year term of office with no possibility of renomination or a second term. 2. Grants Congress the authority to overturn a Supreme Court decision by a 3/5 vote of the House and Senate, and 3. Grants the states authority to overturn a Supreme Court decision if 3/5 of the state legislatures pass resolutions doing so. The justices individually and the court generally retain their independence. The justices continue to select, hear, and decide cases without interference from Congress, the executive branch, or the states. Moreover, they serve for a term longer than any two-term president and without fear of political retribution. There is no change in the court's core judicial functions or the independence of the court as an institution. However, the proposed amendment provides that the final say in certain matters of overarching national significant need not be left to a mere 5 lawyers, allowing Congress and or the states to act by a supermajority vote. There are also important breakwaters to prevent potential abuse of the override processes included in the language of the proposed amendment. Whether the override of a decision originated in Congress or with the state legislatures, it would apply only to the four corners of the majority opinion of the specific Supreme Court decision. It could not be used to parse the meaning of a decision or entangle precedent. The override would simply expunge the holding of the court. If there are conflicting rulings by lower courts within or among the different judicial circuits, these would stand as the ruling precedents on the legal and or constitutional issues relating to the litigation in those forums. Even now, the court takes up only a small fraction of the thousands of cases appealed to it each year, leaving conflicts and issues unresolved all the time. Nonetheless, there are always certain cases involving significant national matters, such as the constitutionality of the Obamacare law, that require resolution. The issue, then, is how to resolve them. Under the proposed amendment, the court is still free to take up such cases and rule on them, but Congress and or the state legislatures will also be free to override the decision with supermajority votes. By adding the override, for the first time justices will know that their most significant majority opinions may not be solely judged by history, but by the people who must live under them, with the possible ignominy of having a ruling overridden by a supermajority of the legislative branches. The override also has the benefit of requiring a fairly substantial societal consensus in order to be successfully invoked in the first place. This is also the primary reason the proposed amendment prescribes a presidential veto of an override. Furthermore, as explained, override attempts would be time-limited. Therefore, a party or faction out of power that suddenly wins a broad mandate cannot go back over several years and override long-settled issues. The time limit also means that issues on which the override is invoked must be genuinely problematic, and not merely pursued as a political expedient. The Supreme Court typically decides more than 100 cases a year, and the time, financial resources, manpower, and political capital necessary to shepherd an override through to reality would require sound judgment on the selection of matters worthy of focused efforts. Finally, in transitioning from the current life tenure of a justice to the term limit, the proposed amendment's mechanism is borrowed from Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, and the framers' method of putting the Senate on a cycle in which one-third of the senators are chosen every 2 years. After the first election in 1789, the senators were organized into three classes, with the terms of the senators in the first class expiring in 2 years, the terms of the senators in the second class expiring in 4 years, and the terms of the senators in the third class expiring in 6 years. Applying this concept to the Supreme Court, the proposed amendment divides the sitting Supreme Court justices into three classes by reverse seniority, with the terms of the longest-serving justices expiring first. For example, if the proposed amendment applied today, the first class would consist of Associate Justices Antonin Scalia, Anthony Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas, whose terms would expire in 4 years. The second class would consist of Associate Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, and Chief Justice John Roberts, whose terms would expire in 8 years. And the third class would consist of Associate Justices Samuel Alito, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, whose terms would expire in 12 years. In such a scenario, conservatives might object that three of the originalist members of the court would be lost in the first wave of term-limited justices. A closer examination reveals more complexity. Of the three justices in the first class, Scalia and Kennedy are both 77 years old. Thomas is 65. By the time the state convention process would be organized by two-thirds of the states and its work completed, followed by the state ratification process, which requires approval of the amendments by a three-fourths supermajority of the states, it is highly unlikely those three justices would still be on the court. The process underscores that this proposed amendment is not about individual justices or political advantage, but strengthening the republican nature of our government. James Madison and his fellow convention delegates wisely settled on an independent judiciary, but they were troubled about the prospect of a supreme judiciary. Madison wrote, "As the courts are generally the last in making the decision, it results to them, by refusing or not refusing to execute a law, to stamp it with its final character. This makes the judiciary department paramount, in fact, to the legislature, which was never intended and can never be proper. The proposed amendment seeks to address what, in fact, has come to be." Chapter 5. Two Amendments to Limit Federal Spending and Taxing. Spending. Section 1. Congress shall adopt a preliminary fiscal year budget no later than the first Monday in May for the following fiscal year, and submit said budget to the President for consideration. Section 2. Shall Congress fail to adopt a final fiscal year budget prior to the start of each fiscal year, which shall commence on October 1st of each year, and shall the President fail to sign said budget into law, an automatic, across-the-board, 5% reduction in expenditures from the prior year's fiscal budget shall be imposed for the fiscal year in which a budget has not been adopted. Section 3. Total outlays of the United States government for any fiscal year shall not exceed its receipts for that fiscal year. Section 4. total outlays of the United States government for each fiscal year shall not exceed 17.5% of the nation's gross domestic product for the previous calendar year. Section 5. Total receipts shall include all receipts of the United States government, but shall not include those derived from borrowing. Total outlays shall include all outlays of the United States government, except those for repayment of debt principal. Section 6. Congress may provide for a one-year suspension of one or more of the preceding sections in this article by a three-fifths vote of both houses of Congress, provided the vote is conducted by roll call and sets forth the specific excess of outlays over receipts or outlays over 17.5% of the nation's gross domestic product. Section 7. The limit on the debt of the United States held by the public shall not be increased unless three-fifths of both houses of Congress shall provide for such an increase by roll call vote. Section 8. This amendment shall take effect in the fourth fiscal year after its ratification. Taxing. Section 1. Congress shall not collect more than 15% of a person's annual income, from whatever source derived. Person shall include natural and legal persons. Section 2. Congress shall not collect tax on a decedent's estate. Section 3. Congress shall not institute a value-added tax or national sales tax or any other tax in kind or form. Section 4. This amendment shall take effect in the fourth fiscal year after its ratification. The nation is teetering on financial ruin due to the unconscionable profligate spending, borrowing, taxing, and money printing by the federal government. Several decades ago, Dr. Milton Friedman, an iconic economist and Nobel laureate, concluded that it is not in the interest of a legislator to vote against a particular appropriation bill if that vote would create strong enemies, while a vote in its favor would alienate few supporters. That is why simply electing the right people is not a solution. The solution is to remove by constitutional design that which cannot be accomplished statutorily, the overwhelming political incentive for reckless government spending by the governing masterminds. For more than 4 years, since April 29, 2009, Congress and the President have refused to adopt a budget. Both branches were in violation of the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act of 1974, Budget Act. And during this period and since, the federal government has unleashed a spending blitz unparalleled in American history. The Budget Act sets forth a budgeting process requiring the president to propose a budget in February, Congress to adopt an annual budget resolution setting forth its budget blueprint, Congress to subsequently pass a budget resolution laying out timetables for completing a final budget, and a final budget, which the president either signs or vetoes. However, from fiscal year 2010 through the early part of 2013, Congress passed 16 continuing resolutions, which are stopgap funding measures, because the Senate refused to comply with the Budget Act's requirements. In addition to short-term spending bills, Congress has also legislated by passing massive omnibus bills that even voting members cannot comprehend. For example, in 1989, Congress passed a Budget Reconciliation Act that one prominent member of Congress described as follows. So voluminous was this monster bill that it was hauled into the chamber in an oversized box. Its thousands of pages, which the clerk hadn't even time to number, had to be tied together with rope, like newspapers bundled for recycling. While reading it was obviously out of the question, it's true that I was permitted to walk around the box and gaze upon it from several angles, and even to touch it. Rather than enforcing budgetary and spending discipline, Congress and the President have raised the debt limit 11 times between 2001 and 2012, increasing massively the federal debt by trillions of dollars. Clearly, Congress and the President knowingly subvert their own legal budgetary requirements for the purpose of increasing spending while attempting to mask political responsibility from the public. They are dragging the nation into a financial death spiral. Their opportunism and dysfunction threaten an impending financial implosion that presages the eventual collapse of the nation's currency and economy, resulting in unimaginable devastation and misery. Therefore, restraint must be imposed on a broken federal system by constitutional amendment, and if possible, promptly. 4 years following ratification of the proposed spending amendment, Congress must adopt a final annual fiscal year budget prior to the start of each fiscal year, keep spending at or under 17.5% of the gross domestic product, GDP, each fiscal year, requiring Congress and the executive branch to prioritize appropriations, and balance the federal budget each fiscal year with a proviso for emergencies, thereby starting to limit the hemorrhaging of spending and debt accumulation passed from one generation to the next. As the facts make undeniable, the nation is running out of time. Federal fiscal spending in real dollars has increased to unsustainable levels. For fiscal operations alone, in 2002, the federal government spent a little over $2 trillion. By 2008, it spent $2.98 trillion. In 2009, federal spending increased to $3.5 trillion. For 2010 and 2011, federal spending was $3.45 and $3.6 trillion, respectively. In 2012, federal spending was $3.79 trillion. As a percentage of GDP, federal spending for fiscal operations is historically sky-high. In 2002, federal outlays as a percentage of GDP were 19.1%. By 2008, outlays increased to 20.8%. In 2009, it increased to 25.2%. For 2010 and 2011, spending as a percentage of GDP was 24.1% respectively. In 2012, outlays accounted for 24.3% of GDP. Federal deficits for annual fiscal operations have increased astronomically. In 2002, the federal government incurred a budget deficit of $157 billion. In other words, spending on current government operations for the year exceeded receipts by $157 billion. By 2008, the budget deficit increased to $458 billion. In 2009, it jumped to a staggeringly high $1.4 trillion. In 2010 and 2011, it reached $1.29 trillion for each year, $2.58 trillion total. For 2012, the federal deficit was $1.32 trillion. In May 2013, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, released information widely touted as good news. The fiscal operating deficit was estimated to be $642 billion, $200 billion less than the CBO had originally projected, and 4% of GDP. But Keith Hennessey, former director of the U.S. National Economic Council, explained, "Anytime you hear a deficit number, compare it to 0, 2, and 3, and you'll have a good feel for where we are. A 4% deficit for this year is not good. It's almost twice as high as the historic average, and it's high enough that our debt will continue to increase faster than our economy will grow." In contrast, while some state governments are horribly managed, many require the enactment of yearly balanced budgets. In 2008, it was reported that governors in 44 states are required to submit balanced budgets, of which 34 are mandated by state constitutions and 10 by state statutes. 41 states require their legislatures to pass annual balanced budgets, of which 33 are compelled by state constitutions and the remaining 8 by state statutes. However, with increases in yearly federal deficits come increases in the overall federal debt. The total federal debt resulting solely from spending on fiscal operations as a percentage of GDP has increased dramatically since 2002. In 2002, this debt as a percentage of GDP was 58.8%. By 2008, it rose to 69.7%. In 2009, it jumped to 85.2%. In 2010 and 2011, debt as a percentage of GDP was 94.2% and 98.7%, respectively. For 2012, federal debt was 104.8% of GDP. Consequently, federal debt is now larger than the entire annual value of all the goods and services produced by the nation's private sector. The federal debt, in real dollar amounts for fiscal operations, has also reached staggering heights. For 2008, the figure was $10.69 trillion, $12.14 trillion in 2009, $13.8 trillion in 2010, $15.22 trillion in 2011, and more than $16.3 trillion in 2012. The federal debt for fiscal operations under the Obama administration has increased almost $6 trillion. In 2012, as a result of this massive debt, every taxpayer was on the hook for $111,000, while the average income was about $51,000. And by 2022, the debt from fiscal operating expenses is estimated to exceed $25 trillion. Simply making the enormous interest payments on this debt will become overwhelming. CBO projects that the government's yearly net interest spending will more than triple between 2011 and 2021, from $225 billion to $792 billion, and double as a share of GDP from 1.5% to 3.3%. According to the CBO, large budget deficits and growing debt would reduce national savings, leading to higher interest rates, more borrowing from abroad, and less domestic investment, which in turn would lower the growth of incomes in the United States. None of this takes into consideration the total unfunded liability of major entitlement programs, which is absolutely ruinous. The total unfunded liability of Medicare as of 2012 was $42.8 trillion. The program's trustees concluded that Medicare spending could consume roughly 10.4% of GDP in 2086. Growth of this magnitude, if realized, would substantially increase the strain on the nation's workers, the economy, Medicare beneficiaries, and the federal budget. The total unfunded liability of Social Security as of 2012 was $20.5 trillion. The program's trustees concluded that, beginning in 2021, annual costs exceed total income, and therefore assets begin to decline at the beginning of 2022. Therefore, total obligations by the federal government, that is, the accumulated debt from yearly fiscal operations plus the net present value of all unfunded liabilities, amounted to over $90 trillion in 2012. Moreover, the real yearly deficits, adding together all debt and liabilities, in 2011 and 2012 were about $4.6 trillion and $6.9 trillion, respectively. Consequently, for the first time in the nation's history, the federal government's credit rating has been downgraded. On August 5th, 2011, citing a negative long-term outlook, the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's downgraded the credit rating of the United States government from the highest AAA rating to AA+. It could be lowered again to AA if the rating agency sees less reduction in spending than agreed to, higher interest rates, or new fiscal pressures during the period resulting in a higher general government debt trajectory. On June 8, 2012, Standard & Poor's affirmed this gloomy outlook, stating, "The negative outlook reflects our opinion that U.S. sovereign credit risks, primarily political and fiscal, could build to the point of leading us to lower our AA+ long-term rating by 2014. In 2012, the Government Accountability Office, GAO, issued its own warning. Having conducted a number of reviews of the federal government's fiscal condition, it reported that the GAO's simulations continue to illustrate that the federal government is on an unsustainable long-term fiscal path. In both the baseline extended and alternative simulations, debt held by the public grows as a share of gross domestic product, GDP, over the long term. While the timing and pace of growth varies depending on the assumptions used, neither set of assumptions achieves a sustainable path. In other words, the nation is facing economic collapse. In response to these utterly ruinous fiscal and financial policies, the Federal Reserve System, Fed, has aggressively pursued monetary policies that are equally alarming. When the Fed was established in 1913, its original mission was to ensure a stable monetary system and sound dollar. Today, the Fed's authority extends to conduct the nation's monetary policy by influencing money and credit conditions in the economy in pursuit of full employment and stable prices, supervise and regulate banks and other important financial institutions to ensure the safety and soundness of the nation's banking and financial system, and to protect the credit rights of consumers, maintain the stability of the financial system and contain systemic risk that may arise in financial markets, provide certain financial services to the U.S. government, U.S. financial institutions, and foreign official institutions, and play a major role in operating and overseeing the nation's payments systems. This is vast power in the hands of a relatively few governing masterminds, 19 individuals who meet every 6 weeks, and 11 of whom vote on monetary policy. As such, with virtually unencumbered power to manipulate markets, over the last several years, the Fed has launched a controversial quantitative easing campaign in which it has monetized trillions of dollars in debt. That is, the Fed creates credit, which is the same as printing money, and uses it to buy federal government bonds, such as treasury notes and mortgage-backed securities, thereby piling debt upon debt and pumping money into the economy. The Fed has also held interest rates at historically low levels for years and has announced it will continue to do so for years to come. In addition, the Fed has stated that it will devalue the dollar by 33% over the next 20 years, which will cut the dollar's value by one-third and drive up prices and costs while reducing the value of savings and investments. Further troubling is the Fed's use of what is dubbed financial repression, where private banks are both forced and encouraged, through loosened capital and other regulatory requirements, to buy ever more government debt. As larger and larger bank holdings consist of this debt, it could eventually set off a financial time bomb, should the government renege on its obligations. Therefore, rather than ameliorating the consequences of out-of-control fiscal policies, born of political ideology and expediency, the Fed's monetary manipulations and interventions are facilitating economic chaos, which can easily lead to hyperinflation and the devaluation of the currency, including sky-high prices and the destruction of wealth, stagflation, including sky-high prices and significant economic contraction, or even deflation and the collapse of prices for goods and services. It is obvious that few institutions are unaffected by the reckless fiscal policies of the federal government, including the Fed's reactionary role respecting its monetary responsibilities, which makes imperative the need to impose constitutional limits on the federal government's spending power. The federal government's fiscal situation is disastrous and dire. The evidence is unequivocal and overwhelming. In Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville warned that ceaseless intervention was a risk for America, resulting from the nature of democracy. In democratic societies, there exists an urge to do something even when the goal is not precise, a sort of permanent fever that turns to innovation of every kind, and innovations are almost always costly. The proposed tax amendment's ceiling on income taxes operates in concert with the spending limitations. It is intended to impose national economic decision-making on Congress by strengthening the link between spending and taxing within our constitutional construct. Capping the income tax will establish a workable, stable, and predictable taxing environment, which encourages enterprise and economic growth. Moreover, the proposed amendment prevents resort to alternative forms of taxation, such as the value-added tax, VAT, for the objective is to shrink the federal leviathan and fund only the legitimate and limited functions of the federal government. It is worth remembering that the framers debated with great force the federal government's size and authority. Many predicted that the federal government's taxing authority, combined with its power to provide for the general welfare, might lead eventually to an unbridled, all-powerful national government, dominating the states and the individual. In one of many examples where the anti-federalists raised prescient concerns, Robert Yates, a.k.a. Brutus, wrote, "It is as absurd to say that the power of Congress is limited to these general expressions, to provide for the common safety and general welfare, as it would be to say that it would be limited had the Constitution said they should have power to lay taxes, etc., at will and pleasure. Were this authority given, it might be said that under it the legislature could not do injustice or pursue any measures but such as were calculated to promote the public good and happiness." Yates argued earlier that the powers of the general legislature extend to every case that is of the least importance. There is nothing valuable to human nature, nothing dear to free men, but what is within its power. It has authority to make laws which will affect the lives, the liberty, and property of every man in the United States. He insisted that the limits placed on Congress's taxing power were insufficient. The legislature has authority to contract debts at its discretion. It is the sole judge of what is necessary to provide for the common defense, and it only is to determine what is for the general welfare. This power, therefore, is neither more nor less than a power to lay and collect taxes, imposts, and excises at its pleasure. Not only the power to lay taxes unlimited as to the amount it may require, but it is perfect and absolute to raise them in any mode it pleases. However, in Federalist 41, James Madison dismissed the critics. He noted that some anti-federalists had asserted that the taxing power amounted to an unlimited commission to exercise every power which may be alleged to be necessary for the common defense or general welfare. But Madison declared that the idea of an enumeration of particulars which neither explain nor qualify the general meaning and can have no other effect than to confound and mislead is an absurdity. Thomas Jefferson, who had not attended the Constitutional Convention, but had followed closely its deliberations, resisted the objections as well. He argued that the power to lay taxes to provide for the general welfare was not viewed by the framers as all-encompassing. For the laying of taxes is the power, and the general welfare the purpose for which the power is to be exercised. Congress are not to lay taxes ad libitum for any purpose they please, but only to pay the debts or provide for the general welfare of the Union. Jefferson understood that allowing Congress to levy taxes for any purpose would essentially be a grant of a distinct and independent power to do any act Congress pleased. Such a grant of power would reduce the Constitution to a single phrase, that of instituting a Congress with power to do whatever would be for the good of the United States, and as they would be the sole judges of the good or evil, it would also be a power to do whatever evil they pleased. Jefferson was certainly not alone in this view. Nonetheless, led by the Massachusetts Ratification Convention in early 1788, several states warned that should the Constitution be ratified, the new Congress needed to place further limits on the grant of federal taxing authority. Amos Singletary, a grist mill operator, father of nine, and local justice of the peace with no formal education, spoke for many during the Massachusetts Ratification Convention. "We contended with Great Britain, some said for a threepenny duty on tea, but it was not that. It was because they claimed a right to tax us and bind us in all cases whatever. And does not this Constitution do the same? Does it not take away all we have, all our property? Does it not lay all taxes, duties, imposts, and excises? And what more have we to give? They tell us Congress won't lay dry taxes upon us, but collect all the money they want by impost. I say there has always been a difficulty about impost, raising enough funds. They will not be able to raise money enough by impost, and then they will lay it on the land and take all we have got. These lawyers and men of learning, and moneyed men, that talk so finely and gloss over matters so smoothly, to make us poor illiterate people swallow down the pill, except to get into Congress themselves, they expect to be the managers of the Constitution, and get all the power and all the money into their own hands, and then they will swallow up all us little folks, like the great Leviathan, Mr. President. Yes. Just as the whale swallowed up Jonah." The Massachusetts delegation voted for ratification, but urged that an amendment to the Constitution provide that when monies raised from impost and excise taxes were insufficient for the national government's purposes, Congress would requisition additional funds from the states to raise as they deemed fit. Only if a state failed or refused to pay a requisitioned amount could Congress levy a tax on the state directly. The Virginia and Rhode Island ratification conventions followed Massachusetts' lead. In the end, however, no change was made to the Constitution, for the enumerations setting forth the limited grant of power to Congress were believed by the state ratification conventions as both obvious and sufficient. In the 1830s, Supreme Court Associate Justice Joseph Story, considered one of the greatest legal minds of his time, emphasized the limits on the Constitution's taxation authority. "Jefferson's opinion on Congress's limited power to tax and appropriate has been maintained at different and distant times by many eminent statesmen. It was avowed and apparently acquiesced in the state conventions called to ratify the Constitution, and it has been on various occasions adopted by Congress, and may fairly be deemed that which the deliberate sense of a majority of the nation has at all times supported." Story's own view was that the specific language of the taxation clause, in which Congress may lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States was indeed limiting. For Story, it was obvious that the drafters intended the power to tax to apply to only three purposes: to pay the debts, to provide for the common defense, and to provide for the general welfare of the United States. The power to tax is strictly tied to these three purposes. It is not a general unlimited power, granting Congress plenary authority, contrary to the specific enumeration of powers in Article 1, the explicit recognition of individual and state sovereignty in the Bill of Rights, and the matrix of checks and balances built into the Constitution. No one believes the framers intended to create, as Story explained, an unlimited national government. Story underscored the importance of placing limits on federal power to levy and collect taxes. A power to lay taxes for any purposes whatsoever is a general power. A power to lay taxes for certain specified purposes is a limited power. A power to lay taxes for the common defense and general welfare of the United States is not, in common sense, a general power. It is limited to those objects. It cannot constitutionally transcend them. If the defense proposed by a tax be not the common defense of the United States, if the welfare be not general but special or local, as contradistinguished from national, it is not within the scope of the Constitution. This should, once and for all, put to rest the notion that by general welfare, the framers intended to grant Congress general power to tax. The Federalists insisted the Constitution effectively limited the taxing authority, whereas the Anti-Federalists were concerned that the language would be distorted by future Congresses. There was overwhelming concurrence that Congress should not be, and was not, granted plenary taxing power. For the first few decades of the nation's history, it appeared that Madison and the other delegates were correct in concluding that the taxing power would be applied as intended. But over time, Congress pushed its limits. In 1861, in order to pay for the growing Civil War debt, Congress passed the Revenue Act, which included an income tax. However, it was repealed in 1872 because it was considered an emergency tax. Indeed, in writing to the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, the then Commissioner of Internal Revenue urged the tax's repeal. He argued that the income tax was the one of all others most obnoxious to the genius of our people, being inquisitorial in its nature, and dragging into public view an exposition of the most private pecuniary affairs of the citizen. In 1894, Congress enacted a flat-rate income tax. But in 1895, in Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company, the Supreme Court ruled that the income tax was an unconstitutional direct tax. A direct tax is a type of tax levied upon the individual directly, rather than a tax levied on the purchase of a good or the importation of a good from outside the country. Under the Constitution, direct taxes must be apportioned among the states, meaning each state must pay its portion of the total tax based on that state's percentage of the general population. However, the federal income tax was a central goal of the progressive movement, and in 1909, President William Howard Taft urged its adoption through the passage of a 16th Amendment to the Constitution. It was passed quickly by Congress the same year. By 1913, three-fourths of the states ratified it. Then, as now, much of the political debate for the federal income tax was based on shifting the burden of taxation from the broader population to a much smaller segment of society. Nonetheless, the early tax